Hello? Hello? Is there anyone out there? Welcome back to the Storytelling for Social Impact podcast, the podcast where we help all of you out there who are doing amazing things in the world, trying to create positive impact to tell better stories so that you can accelerate and magnify the impact that you're having in the world. We talk about amazing examples that worked really well and why they work, and also examples of campaigns that often haven't worked as well or used to work and don't work anymore, and also why that is and how things are adapting and changing. I have a wonderful guest today, Richard Turner. He's the CEO of SolarAid and has had a long history in fundraising with ActionAid, Oxfam, Team Africa, Farm Africa. And he has had two stints at SolarAid as CEO and has done incredible work there. He has a whole philosophy around renewable fundraising, which is great considering he's in renewable energy. And his SDG is, of course, there is accessible energy for all, which I believe is SDG 7, if I'm right. He talks about how, as a charity, they have catalyzed markets. So they've actually gone into rural areas to, their big mission is to provide energy for everyone, like every single person in all of Africa. And believe it or not, there's still huge swathes of Africa that still do not have access to energy. So through solar energy, they have catalyzed rural markets where the solar energy companies would not be confident to go to because they don't feel there's an actual market there. But through philanthropy, they've actually set up the market, established a market so that then the commercial companies can come in and actually take over. So they see their role as a kind of a key component in helping to energize Africa. It's a fascinating story. It talks about how the power of storytelling has helped them along their journey, how you have to tell different types of stories to different types of partners and stakeholders, depending on what their interest is or their risk appetite, if you like, and how enabling other people to tell your story for you is actually an incredibly powerful thing to unlock so much more potential. So let's dive right in, and here we go. You've got a big sort of wonderful thing that's happened recently, and before we start, give me the context of the thing that's just happened.
Okay, so what's amazing is in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world, so probably one of the poorest communities in the world, and they are paying for the energy they use.
Wow.
And the reason that's exciting is because that's sustainable and they are, you know, they're getting a service. So it makes it, you know, charities can give stuff away, but will it last? So this is a model we've developed, you know, in conjunction with the community about how to crack that. Mm-hmm. Now, philanthropy has played an important part because what I've learned is philanthropy allows you to take risk and allows you to do things that even a business would struggle to do. And so what you've got, and this is why I love working for SolarAid, is you've got this place where philanthropy and business-based solutions meet.
Nice.
And so I think that's what's been exciting about it. And I was responsible for raising the funds, and we raised just over $1 million over a period of time. And it was really interesting, the different stages. Mm-hmm. And which funders came in when, and there was a certain sort of logic to it.
And I guess also, no doubt, bringing people on board, setting the vision, believing in what was possible, you know, all of that required you to tell stories to inspire people to come with you, right?
Totally. And then, you know, to begin with, it's an idea. You've got no photos, you've got nothing. And, you know, and then you've got your first, you know, your first start of it, and then you've got a bit more of a story. And then down the line, you've got very different sorts of funders. They're less interested maybe in the personal stories. They're more interested in the wider narrative of what this means and the data. You know, and of course, data is a story as well. So you've got to know which funders to go to when. And this was extraordinary. We hardly had any one turn us down, and we had quite a few examples where people were inviting us, you know, almost saying, you know, would you please apply? And I think there's still this very nice underlying narrative, which we're, I think, culminated in yesterday, which was this realization that we're going to have reached 100% of this entire community. So it's made up of lots and lots of villages across this place. And of course, there's probably someone got married today who's going to need lighting installed. But as of that day,
yes,
we believed we'd reached 100%.
That's incredible.
And what's really interesting, Rav, is there are lots of solar organisations now operating in Africa, but they tend to think about how can we sell more products, how can we get... They don't think, how can we reach 100% of a particular community? So it's a different mindset.
Yes.
And you know, this is what we're pushing people to. Because if they woke up every morning and thought that, versus how can we sell more,
yes,
they would do things slightly differently. Well, quite differently.
And I'm guessing too, I mean, if before we get into kind of what different types of stories you needed to tell to different funders and going back, you know, a bit, what was the mission? What was the initial mission? It's around solar. It's around, you know, developing parts of the world. What was the problem, if you like, and why was this whole kind of mission or goal hatched, if you like?
Okay, so, you know, in the bigger context, and I can talk about one of the sustainable development goals related to energy, but, you know, our mission has always been, you know, giving people access, or our vision is access to renewable energy. But what's become clear is, you know, in order to get that into where it matters, in our homes or, you know, schools or clinics in these rural settings, we've realised it is this mission of 100%. So take any area, and of course the mission is sub-Saharan Africa, where lack of access to electricity is just...
And kerosene and all these things were the previous solution, right? Which has a lot of problems.
Kerosene, huge issues. Still used widely in, you know, countries like Madagascar. Kerosene is widely used. Less so in places like Malawi because it's landlocked, so it's so expensive. So they use candles or torch batteries. But yeah, it's still a huge issue. And our challenge, our reflection was, well, so the wider mission is, you know, how do we get everyone get access? But then take any community like this one in Kasakula, and we deliberately chose one of the poorest places in one of the poorest countries in the world. So the mission we set off on, which was about 5 years ago, was how could we enable everyone to have access to renewable energy, to effectively have electricity? How could we do 100%? So that was the sort of mission of that project. And there was lots of learning along the way, lots of failure, but that was our goal. And
as a charity, if you started out looking at that as a charity, the typical person in the street would think, okay, so what you're going to do is you're going to raise money and then you're going to give them the lamps or whatever. So when in the journey did you think there was a better way or a different way?
I think SolarAid has always had that philosophy. It was set up by an entrepreneur. And very early on, it had to make a choice between perhaps that more aid handouts and, you know, a more entrepreneurial business-based solutions. And so it's always had that in its DNA. You know, so solar products, amazing as they are, when you can get them into the hands of families, we very rarely give them away. You know, maybe in a few exceptional circumstances. So we sell them. And what you learn very quickly, that moves faster than handouts. It's better because you're the customer, so you're not a beneficiary. If this product here breaks,
yes,
you get a right to have it replaced. If you've got to teach people about warranties. and you start to build a market and you start to create jobs. So it's always, and it's lasting. So in this model is a little different for reasons I can go into, in that people don't actually buy the products, they buy a service. But it's sustainable. And now that it's set up, it won't need any more charitable funding.
Okay, so your job is to get it set up and up and running. Is that...
Well, yes, and also to prove to other organisations you could do this. So maybe there's an outfit in Nigeria that could apply this, or Sierra Leone, or other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. If we can do it in Malawi,
yes,
one of the poorest countries in Africa, surely it can be done elsewhere. So I think what our thinking was is to really prove it, share it. We don't want to set up solar aid across other parts of Africa. That's highly expensive and slow as well.
Yeah.
What we want to do is enable these extraordinary solar enterprises, which already exist, and say to them, there's a market in some of these communities, rural areas, which they don't tend to go to. They tend to go to the more affordable, usually near urban areas.
Well, they probably don't think it's possible. So I guess you're showing that it is possible. You know, or maybe they think it's too hard, or...
Yeah. So, I mean, you're running a small business. You tend to think, okay, where can I, you know, where can we...
Make the most money.
Make a profit.
Yeah.
And so you focus on those areas where easy access and more affordable. You're not going to go to the remote rural areas where there might not be the demand or the understanding. Mm. And so we realise our job is to bridge that. And what's fascinating, you know, we're a charity, but we own a social enterprise. So in Africa, we're called Sunny Money. And it allows us to do things. Yeah, everybody brings a smile when you say Sunny Money.
Yeah.
It allows us to do things that businesses can't, but it also makes us do things that a lot of charities don't either.
Yes.
So we live in this sort of quite interesting space that I think is fascinating. And it means then we're trying to come up with solutions that last. And in the context of USAID funding going and so on, I think we need these sort of creative solutions that don't necessarily have that dependence on aid.
Yeah.
But, you know, philanthropy can be that catalyst that has that help breakthrough moment that can then, you know, lead to solutions even in the sort of areas that we're talking about.
Yeah. Sometimes they call it patient capital, isn't it? It's like you said, the capital that's willing to take the risk to see if it's what is possible before, you know, the feasibility, I guess, almost, or early stage support just to get something up and running that a business might not do, or a full out investor might not do.
Yes. I mean, I those sort of phrases sort of go above my head. You know, I really think at the root of it, it is, you know, when people give, I've learned over the years, people give because they need to. You know, they get something in return. And so I think there is something in that as well. And, you know, when I can communicate back to a donor, look, what, as I've been doing in the last 24 hours, remember that project you helped fund in the early stages? Look what we've achieved. Look what your funding has enabled as a result. And so... but exactly that, you know, that I find that people with philanthropy, they've already let go of that money. They're not investors in the sense that they're expecting any money back. They'd love something back,
yes,
but it won't be their money. But they've already let it go. In their mind, I'm giving you this money because I can afford to. And I think the role of me, even though I'm a fundraiser, I think it is about storytelling. It's about telling them the story that they've enabled, and that's giving them value back. And I'd like to think it's giving them such value back that they'll go, Richard, you know,
let's
what else
again.
Have you got? They're like, yes. And that happens because I think we love stories, don't we? You know, we love to feel part of something and making something happen. So,
yeah
I think there's some really... fascinating stuff to
yeah Yeah, I remember hearing a little bit about it from you a couple of years ago. And so tell me if I've kind of understood the problem, if you like, correctly. In a lot of rural places, in places like Africa, you know, things like doing homework late at night, or as you said, you know, in medical clinics, or even just the family coming together to do anything once it's dark, kerosene lamps are the norm. They're expensive, they're dangerous, they can start fires, there's fumes, all of that. So the solar, I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer, isn't it? In somewhere like Africa where there's so much sun, it's such a huge resource that, you know, they could tap into. Is that the kind of narrative, though, the thing that you share in terms of story about solar lamps? Is it like it enables education, it enables... What, how do you kind of tell the story about what it is more than just a device, how it transforms people's lives, if you like?
Yeah, there's been huge progress since solar aid started. I mean, countries we used to work, like Tanzania, where we distributed the best part of 1 million
wow.
solar lights. You know, we don't operate there because we're not needed. And you can go, in fact... former chief executive was in Tanzania, and he was in the area we operated near Arusha. And what was notable in the markets where these sort of things, a kerosene lamp would be for sale, there weren't any.
Wow.
You know, they were just weren't available. What was available were lots of great solar products. So there has been quite a dramatic change. And I think there has been in the news recently about solar really taking across, really exploding across Africa.
Mm.
But the area we're really focused on is the sub-Saharan, you know, below the Sahel, and particularly rural communities, where there are sort of, you know, there's still the best part of 600 million, just under 600 million people who don't have access to electricity. And although there's been great advances, it's, you know, the sustainable development goal that I'm going to touch on, number 7, is everyone should have access to energy. And that's just not going to be achieved by the end of this decade. Mm. So the question is, how do you start closing that gap? And how do you close the gap for those that are going to benefit the most? Mm. And if you look at the map of the world, and you know, colour countries by access to electricity, you know, sub-Saharan Africa just leaps out. I mean, don't get me wrong, there have been some amazing developments in India, for example. Access to solar energy there've been some real breakthroughs there. Mm. But our focus is sub-Saharan Africa, and we operate in a couple of places which allow us to sort of experiment, if you like, and try out ideas like Lighter Village Project we're celebrating with a view that we can replicate them elsewhere. Back to your point, totally, you know, enables children to study, enables mothers to give birth not in the dark or by a burning, you know, candle or kerosene lamp. Or we hear stories of midwives with telephones, you know, in their mouths trying to
shine a light.
They're sort of basics that we take for granted that would change the everyday. And that could, you know, really have a huge impact on people's lives.
Mm. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, are you saying that Africa is a market opportunity for solar companies, but they are operating mostly around the more established city markets, and you're working in the harder to reach areas to try and sort of, I guess, show what's possible and then inspire, you know, them to maybe, you know, because obviously to reach all of Africa, it will need, especially if you want it to transfer over to the businesses, I suppose, are you trying to show an example to them that it's possible elsewhere? Or do you think it'll always require people like SolarAid to operate in those harder to reach areas?
No, very much the latter. I mean, if we can demonstrate that there's a market and how to do it and share our models, then absolutely. You know, you're talking about one of the most entrepreneurial, vibrant continents in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And so if we can instill ideas and share our learning about what works, and and we're doing our best to work not just with other solar enterprises, but with NGOs. We're operating with some NGOs in Madagascar who really know the local community, but they don't know much about solar, and in particular about business models that can work. So we're sort of that guide, even though we don't operate in Madagascar, we can guide them. So I think there's a sort of niche role that we can play. And there are thousands of these businesses, enterprises operating. And yeah, you're right. They, how do we get them to believe, we could get solar products to these sort of customers, and how to do that in a sustainable way, which works for everybody. And there are lots of other issues we're leading on, these products, their technology, they're going to stop working. Bizarrely, I've probably had this for probably 10 years now, and it's still fine. But, maybe after 4 or 5 years, they can stop. The battery needs replacing.
Yes.
We're trying to get the sector to think about that. How do you get access to these products? Where are there spare parts? How do we provide training? The sort of thing that needs collaboration. And we seem to be playing a role in coordinating that in a way that any single business just wouldn't be able to do.
And what's interesting is you're kind of, it seems like you're almost building the market, because I think it's very inspiring to hear, like in Tanzania, because I know you did a lot of work there for a long time, that once it hit sort of critical mass, if you like, that then you've moved on elsewhere. Like you're not there to light the match, if you like, and to set the ball rolling in a way, if you like, but you're happy to move on when others can pick up the mantle. Is that correct?
Yeah, good use of lighting the match. Yeah, good. Yeah. Exactly that. Catalyze a market is probably the language we have previously used. And I think what we're realizing is creating these business models, and the one that we've achieved this milestone this week is an example of it's almost like a no-brainer. When when you explain it, you go, really? Has no one tried that before? But now we've got the evidence and the proof, and there's a lot of excitement about how other organizations can replicate this. And we're already in advanced discussions with a solar enterprise in Senegal and another in Sierra Leone, and they're doing exactly the same thing, and we're swapping data and learning, and we'll share this wider and wider. So yeah, absolutely, we're trying to take that risk. That philanthropy and support we get from donations enables us to do that, and then we can sort of pass that on across to other solar enterprises and businesses to try it for themselves.
Jumping in for a quick advert from our sponsors, Be Inspired Films. If you would like to harness the power of story to magnify the impact of your work around the world, then we can definitely help. Are you trying to raise funds to do the important work you need to do? Are you looking to attract the best talent so that you can achieve those big goals? Do you have a new service or campaign you're looking to launch? Or do you just want to make sure that people know about the great work that you're doing and you can demonstrate to the people that have already supported you, like funders or partners, how well the work you've done has gone? We believe as bold adventurers of change, together we can voyage from thinking short-term marketing to co-creating long-term meaning and purpose for you and your audience. We'll help you create powerful digital assets across video, animation, podcasting, documentary, and events that will magnify your impact and together nudge us all one step closer to solving the world's biggest problems. It all does start with a deep dive to help you get complete clarity on your core stories and then the confidence to tell those stories in clear, captivating, and compelling ways. So do get in touch if you'd like to tell stories that can change the world. Go to beinspiredfilms.com or send us an email at hello@beinspiredfilms.com, and we'd love to explore the options with you. Now let's get straight back to the podcast. What's the big, if you were to give us the press release, what's, I know you had a huge achievement yesterday. What, how would you put it in a nutshell?
Well, I guess the, you know, a bit like a blown up version of yesterday, you know, yesterday was we 100% access for Casa Coola.
Is that so, like an area, like a community?
Yeah. Casa Coola is this, is made up of lots of villages. So we've reached just under 9,000 households there. That's about, what will it be about, 45,000 people or so.
Wow.
And so, you know, one day we'll be able to say 100% access across Malawi. And one day we might be able to say energy access
across Africa.
Across Africa. I mean, you wouldn't, you know, if we said 100% energy access across the UK, you'd go, yeah, you know, it's taken as granted, isn't it? So wouldn't it be great if we get to that spot? And of course, there's different levels of it. You know, we're talking about basic lighting and being able to charge maybe a mobile phone or a radio. But, you know, people have greater aspirations as well. And there's you know, they'd love to be able to watch television or power other devices, you know. And so I think that's to come, you know, fridges for clinics and so on, pumps for farmers to irrigate their crops. We're starting to see the beginnings of that already. But the most fundamental and the one we've focused on for some time is light, because, you know, without light at 6 o'clock across a lot of, you know, certainly, you know, the countries around the, you know, around the equator, it gets dark and your day stops, or you light a candle, and they're not very nice candles, you know, they're sort of paraffin candles that spit and emit carbon as well, or a kerosene lamp, or you buy some very poor quality torch batteries. But it's, you know, and then it's, and that's expensive as well, well as dangerous and not good for your health.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the solar lights, obviously they're sustainable in the sense that every day they can charge up from the sun. What is the economic model? If they don't pay for the device, what are they paying for, and how do they pay for it?
Okay, so there are different models. So there are models where people do pay for the device. You know, they'll buy one like the Sun King over my shoulder here, or, you know, a little study light like this. And what we do is we train up local entrepreneurs. So we, because a lot of fake products and poor quality products out there. So how do they know that they're buying a really good product and, you know, service their customers? Sometimes they might allow their customers to pay for it in installments or in different ways, and make people aware, you know, that, you know, if it breaks, they have the right to get it replaced if it's within warranty. And even if they don't, you know, repair is something we're leaning into as well. So there is the there's the outright side. But this is quite small. So, a solar lamp like this is a study, what we call a study light. It, you know, it would enable someone to light up a desk, and the one over my shoulder might light up a room. But what people really need is something like this.
Oh, wow.
So this is a solar home system, and there are lots of different products out there. This one's made by a company called Omnivoltaic. But this would cost about $100 to buy. And if you're living below the poverty line,
it's a lot, yeah.
You're just not going to afford it. And a lot of organizations have been trying that. The model they've been doing is trying to get people to buy these on a sort of pay-as-you-go basis. So give me $10, and then every month you give me another $5, and you pay it off
over time,
maybe over 12 to 18 months. But ultimately, someone doesn't keep up their payments, and quite a high proportion of these, you know, get taken back because people couldn't sustain them. And then businesses don't go to the poorest places because they don't think the customers could afford to pay for them anyway. So the model we've just done, where you get access to this sort of system, which comes with three lights and a battery unit and a panel that you put on your home.
Yeah.
So it's a panel about the size of a laptop. we install for free, which actually is no different. You know, in your home, you didn't pay for the infrastructure, all the you know, the cables and stuff. You pay Octopus Energy, whoever, for the energy you use. And so we have exactly the same principle, is we install this at no cost to the customer, and then they pay for the energy they use. And the way we do that is you have this unit is, so you can see it's 50% charge. I was using it yesterday. And they tap in a code, and that gives them access to to charge light their home or charge devices. And we've priced it so it's less than the cost of buying candles. Okay. So the cost of buying candles each week, it's cheaper to buy.
So cheaper than the previous cost that they would have had, but obviously far superior.
Far superior, safer, brighter. What we found is families put one of these outside their home, and we couldn't understand why. And it was, because it keeps the hyenas away, for example. And and they don't take the risk. So if this product breaks, we replace it, because that's the arrangement.
The bargain,
and we also have now, because we're getting a small fee from customers, so it's about 100 kwacha, which is about 4 pence for each day they want to use it. That means we can replace the battery when this fails in 5 years' time, or maybe the LED goes on one of the lights. So we provide a service which actually isn't provided by, you know, it's local people who are employed to deliver this service, which we've sort of overseen. So you're creating local jobs as well. But you're also enabling children to read after sunset so they can do their homework. Teachers can prepare homework. Farmers can prepare their produce, maybe for market or whatever it need be. So the knock-on effects are
huge. Yeah, guess you're unlocking a whole part of the evening that previously, you know, it was harder for them to do stuff in if it was dark, you know, extending their day essentially in some respects.
Exactly. And actually, one of those important things is just social time together. So enabling that as well. Although one of the interesting anecdotes I've been told is when these are installed initially, one of the first things that happens is the children rush into the home and go and get their school books and start reading. And dancing. Lots of dancing.
Lots of dancing.
People dancing as well. And the emotion. What we've learned is, you know, fundraisers tend to look at the before and after. So we tended to focus on people using kerosene or candles and using the light.
Yes.
And then the penny dropped. The most magical moment is when someone turns on one of these for the very first time.
Yeah.
And the look in their face is just amazing. I mean, they are just, they, you can see the emotion where they're going, I have electricity in my home. I have light. And so to get, but to be there for that real moment, you know, not a made up moment, but a real moment with a really, you know, with a good photographer who knows what they're doing when you're dealing with darkness and light, that's not easy to do.
No.
But we've, because that story is so critical, we've really strived hard to capture what we call that magic moment.
Yeah.
And then it becomes so easy to tell the story of what it means to someone having access to a solar home system like this.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, I can just imagine it's magic, isn't it? Like literally, we use the word, you know, but if it's for the first time that you've seen that, it is literally like it's magic, isn't it?
People say the word magic. I'm not, you know, they've actually said it was like magic. I can quote verbatim from families who have said as much.
Yeah. You know, in the Jungle Book, I think it is, where they talk about the humans, they've been able to capture the red flower, the monkeys say. And they're talking about harnessing that power of fire. And I guess in a way that's what electricity is, isn't it? It's a transformed type of, you know, that energy of fire. And it's transformational, isn't it? It's just massively, it's a whole new world with electricity or without electricity.
Yes, and you know, we take it for granted, don't we? I mean, when I got up this morning, I probably unplugged my phone from its charge. I would have put the kettle on, you know, even during the day.
Hot shower. Light,
shower, yeah.
Everything.
You know, working on a laptop. So it fuels our lives all the time. And so, absolutely. And yet, and the technology is there. So it almost seems, I think, starting to become a bit of an injustice that people don't have access to something so fundamental that makes such an amazing difference to your life.
I agree. And especially given, because we're talking about solar, given there's probably nowhere where there's more sun on the planet than in Africa. You know what I mean? It does seem like your brain is kind of struggling to understand why the equation doesn't add up. You know what I mean? It's like so much sunshine, energy, so much potential for that to be transformed to supply all of the things we just described. Yet, so if you were to, having had all of the time that you've had looking at this and working in this, where do you think some of the barriers or blockages are?
So one is, I think, potentially charities have been guilty of rushing to this solution. And so we come across lots of solar projects, clinics especially, lots of schools, and they no longer work. Because the solar solution was put in, but nobody thought about the underlying business model. How are they going to be maintained?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the barriers is exactly that. How do you think about that right from the get-go? And it's that scalability. And equally, if you're, you know, the cost to cost of electrification, certainly in Malawi, is just huge. And so it's just not viable for even, you know, with, they might have funding from sources like the World Bank, for the government to go with an electrification program that will reach everybody. So that's why solutions like the one I was explaining, where you take these amazing solar home systems, but you're not giving them away. Because if you're giving them away, you're just parking the problem down the line when they all start to break. And you're also damaging the market, you know, for some small business or entrepreneur who's trying to set up.
Yeah.
You know, what you want is something which is, yeah, is a sustainable solution. Maybe it needs an injection of investment. But that's far easier capital to sort of secure than some sort of ongoing, never-ending subsidy that someone needs. So it's not going to charity, and it's not it's also sort of seeing through that business model and overcoming those blockages. You know, if it's to succeed.
Well, talk to me about the different types of funders, because if we think about it as a progression, obviously at some point there becomes an economic model, a sustainable economic model. But in the lead up to that, you know, the different types of people that you brought on board, whether they were individual funds, fundraisers, or whether they were various grant making bodies, etc., and how you brought them in, why them at that point in time, what kind of stories worked for different ones, and did you know inherently how to speak to each of them differently, or did you learn as you dealt with them how to pitch it? What was the process like?
Yeah, well, something I learned years ago, I was at a talk and someone made this fantastic insight, and it was simply that the more people you're dealing with, the less risk they'll take. So if I'm dealing, say you're an individual philanthropist.
Yes.
If I'm talking one-on-one to you, you're more likely to take the risk than if you're a committee of people giving away other people's money.
Yes.
You know, right at the extreme, you could be a government, you know, department.
Yeah.
So that was a brilliant insight. So at the start of this project, we went to one individual, and we went to an individual who'd said to us previously that he and his wife, who set up this foundation, they're willing to fund things that might fail. And so we said, we've got something and it might fail. And that was like bee to a honeypot. Said, loved the idea and gave us the initial funding just to get it going and see if the idea could work. And that funded reaching about 500 homes in this community.
May I ask, is that person an entrepreneur or business owner by background?
So their background is business, but you know, as a result of being successful, you know, they've set up a foundation. So yes,
but they have that inherent like they're more comfortable taking risks to potentially gain, right?
Yes, I think they understand. Check this: the Turner Kirk Trust, fantastic organization, and you know, very refreshing to have a philanthropy where they will openly support things that might fail. And they actually see that's their role, is to help that.
That's wonderful.
And then the next stage, you know, when we said, okay, we want to go bigger, they go, okay, well, we can't fund all of that. But tell you what, we'll fund half if you get the other half. So we could then go to other funders. And now we had some photographs and a few stories. Mm. So that's the next level of people, again, it's some individuals, some small trusts and foundations where you're saying, look, if you could give us £10,000 or £20,000, firstly, we could double it. Mm. And then, you know, we can get it to the next stage, which was to go from 500 homes to 2,500 homes. And so we went to a range of funders and we got about 10 in all, and we raised the £250,000 that we needed to do that next phase.
Mm. How did they differ, that second batch?
Well, they also, they were the early adopters, say, but they probably needed some photographs or some stories. You know, it wasn't just the idea. So you and Kirk, it was the idea, was almost enough. With this group, it was, here's the idea. We've tried it out. We think it's got huge potential, got some pictures and some stories. So enough to talk about it, but not enough evidence. You know, we couldn't prove it was going to work. We just felt that there was potential. And the story, in particular, the story was powerful. You know, this idea, we already knew the concept, you know, that we would install these for free and people will ultimately pay for the energy they use. So we had the narrative, if you like, but it was still unproven.
Was it a factor for them that there were a group of them? They were sharing the risk. Was that a factor, do you think, as well?
Sort of, because you could start to say, oh, well, this funder's on board, are you on board? And then you started to share, well, we're this close, because I could use the match to say, you know, in order to release the match, you know, we need to raise the full, the half amount, the 120,000 or so that we needed. Mm. So that was great as well. And I cannot think of anyone who turned us down, actually, in those first two steps.
It sounds like both of them were, rather than data, they were operating more on emotion or the story, the vision, right? Would you say?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I would say so. And then the third group, that's where the evidence started to come in. So this is where we wanted to take it up to 7,500. Mm. Which was our guess for the population at that time, which actually we've realised later on we were about 1,000 short in terms of, so 7,500 households. But now we had the evidence and data that this is going to work. Mm. And we had funders who were willing to respond to that, giving much bigger grants. So we needed to raise the best part of £500,000 for that. And we even had funders who said, can you apply? You know, they were inviting us because they'd started to hear about us, talk about it at conferences and so forth. So you went to those sort of funders who do relate to a group of people who were giving away other people's money, if you like, found bigger foundations. And some of them even collaborated and they said, oh, well, we'll fund, but we'll bring this funder along with us too. Mm. And then we were in sight of the end goal, Because then we said, oh, actually, we think it's 8,813 is the exact number. And then we had some funders who were the completer finishers who just said, we'll help you get it over the line. And so they were just brilliant. And there was one fund who came with us pretty much
each round.
All the way. And now we've achieved this a fantastic moment, raising the best part of, I think, 1.1 million, which actually is not a lot in the scheme of what I think we've achieved and its potential going forward. Yes, you're right. Each stage was a different sort of way, different strength of the story. And later on, it became more about the overall concept and the data and its potential.
Scalability,
And that allows you to justify, you know, we had to do a survey at the start of the project to prove the difference that we'll be making at the end, you know, the importance of all that data measurement. Lots of learning along the way. You know, we didn't anticipate the rats chewing through cables, for example. But these are the things you learn as you go. And now we've got a model which we think can scale. In fact, the Malawi government, their Ministry of Energy, wants to take it to a district level. Wow. So there are 28 districts across the whole of Malawi. This would be one of those districts, and that would be an increase of tenfold. That would reach about 68,000 households, I believe, in Nchizi district.
Yeah, incredible. I wanted to, if I may, I know I've heard you talk before about your vision for fundraising as a long-term approach rather than sort of short-term and kind of a six-step approach for that. And I love that you actually call it renewable fundraising, given that we're talking about renewable energy. But I'll just remind you of the six parts, and maybe we can say something a little bit about it. So you're talking about the importance of belief at the beginning, understanding your audience, providing them an incredible experience. The one that I like the most, I'd love you to talk about, is enabling other people to tell your story, unlocking that. I think that's a hugely powerful one. Then being ready to react, and then measuring the magic. How did that sort of come about? And what, like, you know, the story has been a huge part of SolarAid's success, but how is that in particular, that one about enabling other people to tell your story on your behalf, such a powerful thing to unlock?
It came about when, and it wasn't that long ago, I think fundraising in the UK was in a bit of a quagmire. You know, it was coming under fire for perhaps quite aggressive techniques, and there were some media stories. And I in some extent I could see why that was happening, and yet I think the world, you know, was changing, and it was that particular one about getting other people to tell a story. I remember reading an author called Grant Leboeuf, and he wrote a really fascinating book called Sticky Marketing. And his insight was this, is that we are being bombarded with messaging, and therefore we start to filter out. And therefore our reliance on our peers is only going to start increasing. And so he was talking about this, you know, ages ago, decades ago. And of course, this device has changed us all. A mobile phone means, you know, we all are channel. And therefore his insight is, how do you get your customers to tell a story? Because so you going to your friends and telling them about SolarAid is far better than me going to your friends and 100%. Telling them about SolarAid. So how do I do that? And as soon as that penny dropped, I thought, let's give that a go. And what I loved about SolarAid, the day I joined them, I think the first story I was told was a story of failure. You know, it was how we tried to put a solar light in a kerosene hurricane lamp, you know, the sort of thing that you might see on an Indiana Jones film. And we thought it was a great idea. But across East Africa, people hated it because it's the symbol of poverty. You know, they wanted a light bulb. They didn't want a hurricane lamp. But I just loved the fact that failure was embraced as a story, and the learning from that is let's go and find the best products out there. So I realized we could try something a bit different when it came to fundraising at SolarAid. Mm. And it was very much, how do we equip people with the story? So therefore, what is the story? And so we had to really sweat exactly that. What is it that we are about? And, you know, and come from that also comes your audience, because whoever your audience are determines the story you might tell. You're going to say, you know, something completely different to an audience of one type versus another. And it led to simple ideas. Like, for example, we started to import these products into the UK, which was quite difficult for a small charity who'd never done that before. You know, we'd done it in Africa. So we could get them into the hands of supporters.
Yes.
And they could see for themselves. You know, one, some of these are just, can be as, the really good but small, like, costs as little as £5 or so. So if people are prepared to give us a regular gift or fundraise or make a reasonable donation, we could offer them a solar light. And what we started to find is, we would get, a company would contact us and say, oh, one of our employees has told us about SolarAid and we want to put you forward for our, a grant. And it's what we call the magic would happen. And it just had this sort of ripple effect. So I've always adhered to that principle. But now I believe it helps in so many other ways. It ensures people continue to support us. And of course, when you're in a cost of living crisis and all these other things, people weigh up, the value they get. And it's embedding that principle.
There's something very tangible. There's something very tangible too, isn't there, about having holding something in your hand, like the solar lamp. I think you might have sent me one a few years ago. And it's just, it brings it home, isn't it? And as you say, it's a fiver, but it becomes just somehow more real, just by having it in your hand.
Yeah, so we've taken it further. We had an amazing company called Bird Sunglasses. They are a supporter, but they're really good at packaging. So we said, hey, could you create a package for us? So they've now created a lovely box.
Oh, nice.
That we put the light in. So when it comes, it also
feels special.
Not just stuffed in a jiffy bag. And then we've put a really nice leaflet with it, which tells the story. You know, the light that you're holding in your hands is the very light that we use in Africa. Please use it to tell other people. So it's really a conduit for us to empower someone else to tell our story to their network of contacts and friends, and give them a great experience. Another of those things are making people feel really good about their giving, and in our case, supporting SolarAid.
Yeah, and over the years, have you kind of distilled down the story like to a couple of lines, or how would you tell it if you needed to tell it very succinctly?
Well, it's changing. So when we started, we distilled it down. We're going to eradicate the kerosene lamp from Africa,
which is powerful. It's visual.
Yeah, it is. But in some extents, this is almost a thing of the past. I mean, certainly in countries like Tanzania and so on, it is a problem in some countries, but a lot less so.
Yes.
Now we're moving more to this 100% vision. How can we reach everyone with affordable energy, and so we're starting to nuance our narrative again. It keeps evolving, and I think that's the lesson I've learned is how do you constantly do that, but do it succinctly, and you need to convey the problem that you're trying to solve and the ambition as well. What's the ambition? And I think if you can get those elements, alongside the solution, those are the three good things, and get them off in a sentence or two, then you start to get people's attention, and then you can tell a story. And I think a lot of the job of fundraising, and this is from an old friend, great fundraiser in himself called Alan Clayton, taught me is the job of the fundraiser is to get people to listen to or read a story. And so getting people's attention in the first place is really, really key. And particularly in this world where, you know, attention is really hard to get hold of.
Absolutely.
Because we've been bombarded with so much.
And how do you bring in new people then? What is your means of, because obviously you've got a good base. So how are you thinking about catching that attention? Like, I imagine, I don't know what would be the criteria to get sent a lamp, but if you did, that's a powerful thing, because like in a digital world, to receive something in the post, especially in a nice package and whatever, is quite powerful. And as you say, it's a gateway to then telling the story. But how are you, or not just for SolarAid, but what do you think about how do we reach new audiences in such a busy climate, like you say?
Yeah, so it's getting, how do you get people to give in the first place?
Or to listen, or to pay attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, because really when they get the lamp, they've already
made
that decision and they're in, and this is to keep them going. And so what we did this extraordinary exercise. We came on this thought that we need to know our audience. And a reflection was, we'd done pretty much up until 5 years ago, a lot of our audience had come sort of organically, with the exception of a few. We'd been fortunate enough to have a few radio appeals and the odd newspaper appeal, but it has sort of come to us. So we went and interviewed a whole selection of them, and the whole staff team got involved, and we recorded the interviews, which went over the best part of an hour, and we just asked people about why, you know, about themselves and why they chose to support SolarAid and so on and so forth. And then we analysed these interviews, and we deliberately chose some people who'd been very active and those that were relatively new, or, you know, perhaps, less stronger supporters. And there was this golden thread that came up again and again. And it started to help us understand who our audience was. And, you know, out of that, we could then determine where to find them. And the golden thread was this anxiety over climate change.
Interesting.
I don't know what to do about climate change. Oh, there's something I can do. And it helps people as well. You know, okay, yes, there's plant a tree and so on, but this, you could feel that sort of penny drop.
Yeah.
And this was helping people cope with this anxiety. So we realized, you know, we started to shift our messaging to talk about benefiting people and planet. And then the other thing that I think that really appealed to people was simply the instant difference that this would make.
Yeah.
And so we started to shift that in our communications. We talked about that instant that you could do. And then that's what we've been using in our marketing to attract people. And it's been, you know, you've got to learn and try things, but it seems to be working. And we seem to be attracting, and I was going to say a new audience. It's not a new audience. It's the audience that is attracted
to us. More of the same audience, if you like.
We know how to get them, and hopefully they will stay with us. And of course, that's the challenge with any fundraising, is how to bring in people. But keep them supporting you, not only giving more, and recommending you to their networks. And we're, you know, SolarAid's not a big organization. I've not got big marketing budgets to work with, so you've got to really work hard. But I think why I call it renewable fundraising is, if it's done well, it just builds year on year. You don't have bumps and troughs. You just steadily grow, and it's sort of rock solid. You've got a foundation that sort of looks after itself if you do the right things. And whereas, you know, I think the reason I used the word renewable is, you know, the opposite of that is extractive, isn't it? You know, extractive fundraising is, how do I get as much money out of
how do I squeeze
and you know, that's where things can start to go wrong. And what I try and tell my team is, the only thing that matters is how can you inspire that person that you're talking to spread our story? That's all that matters. Not about giving more. How do you get them to inspire our story? And then, you know, ironically, the money will come. You know, people will want to give.
And it's interesting. It's something you touched on earlier as well. It's kind of, I think by inspiring them to share and tell the story, then what it does inherently is it increases their identification with the mission. And because by human nature, I think I loved what you said about, like, there's a payoff. So they're giving, but they're also getting to be part of something meaningful. And especially, it's fascinating to hear about your research. Just as that person with the lamp switches it on and there's an instant change in their lives, it's also solving equally for the donor a sense of doing something meaningful where previously they felt hopeless in the face of, you know, the climate crisis or whatever. So I love that there's, I don't know if it's equal, but there's a benefit on both sides. And so it feels very natural. You know, it's not forced. It's each party is benefiting in some way. And then when you start to tell the story of the organization, then it starts to feel more like your own story too, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And people feel they're getting something back from it as well. And I'm always really keen, you know, I love calling up people and just simply asking, can you tell me why you support us? And listening to that answer is fascinating. And you hear all sorts of motivations as well. And you realize there's this sort of two-way exchange, partly in acknowledging that as well, that make people feel good. And I just think there's something beautiful about humanity, you know, when people make a donation. I think it's so to do our utmost in making them feel good, whether it's a phone call, a handwritten note, or if they've supported a project, you know, going to the trouble to update them, you know, even if it's some years later, to say, hey, look, what's been achieved.
Big success.
You know, these are, I think it's our duty to do that sort of thing. And, you know, because if that was the approach, and I think increasingly charities are starting to realise the benefit of that, you know, then we're going to create a culture where people, you know, celebrate giving and they see it as very much part of their every day, in the same way we need that coffee fix most days.
It's part of their almost well-being, you know, because there's a good feeling to be able to help, isn't there? It's one thing that's interesting is we talk a lot in storytelling that we do is like trying to get to the heart of a story. And I think sometimes if we rush to think of storytelling as just marketing, we might try to come up with a clever hook or a clever line or whatever. But I think organizations that take that time, which is an investment of time, you know, to speak to the donor base and do all of those interviews and whatever else, you uncover something at the heart of it that's connects more than just a clever line, if you know what I mean. You know, you found that golden thread. And I think that's, so that's the preparation work, I guess, before the storytelling that can really enhance it.
Yeah. And then it's getting, you know, so like our latest insight is we know that moment when someone turns on the light for the first time is very special. Mm. So the team who are collecting, you know, photography have to work really, really hard to collect those moments. But it's worth it.
Because you've identified it as a key thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, imagine you've got to be in the home when someone's turning on a light for the first time. So just orchestrating and planning all of that really, really helps. And it's, but you're right. Yeah, it's understanding the nature of that story and making them feel part of it. And you know, looking to convey the difference that, in our case, a donation has made, you know, compared to, well, what if that didn't happen? You know, what would be the story otherwise? And you know, we do go there, you know, because there are horrific stories of candles being knocked over, and you know, as a result, you know, school dormitories burning down, and they're just, you know, yeah, they're really, really powerful, and we do touch on those stories because they've shaped our mission. But in, you know, we increasingly we're focusing on that, you know, look what we can achieve, and I think some role in helping people feel good, you know, around all, you know, there's not a lot of good news around at the moment, is there? And I think there's a role that we, and I'd like to think other nonprofits and charities can play, is trying to help people feel good, and particularly if we can come up with these very creative solutions that aren't just you know, plugging a gap temporarily, or you know, they really are trying to sort of shift the dial in terms of sort of ongoing change.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, congratulations on such a milestone. May you have many more. And is the next step to expand it there, or have you got a new area in mind?
Yeah, well, so Casa Coola is in a place called Nchizi District. So the idea is to expand it to Nchizi District. But then, you know, the idea is, if that can be done in Nchizi District in Malawi, is do it across all 28. So that's the vision, and that's the discussion. But then also, how can we do it elsewhere? So we're going to try this model in Zambia. Zambia is a bigger challenge, perhaps not such high levels of poverty, but vast country. So you've got bigger distances to deal with. And then we're obviously really interested in any organization that wants to try that model. And we're working with partners in several countries already in sub-Saharan Africa. So the idea is, yeah, how can we pull together that learning? And we've set up a hub. We call it REAL, the Rural Energy Access Lab, which is going to share that learning and pull people together so we can refine and improve this model, so others can apply it. And you know, so we can accelerate this dream, if you like. It probably feels like a dream at the moment, of how do we achieve 100% energy access for all of those households, clinics and schools that right now have no access to electricity. And unless something changes, you know, by the end of this decade, when sustainable goal number 7 for energy is meant to be achieved, you know, can we get closer? Because at the moment, we're definitely heading, you know, the trajectory is not great, and therefore something has to change. And you know, we think we can be a key part of that story that's going to make that change happen. And I think of all the sustainable goals, energy underpins so many of the others.
Yes.
If this one gets undermined, it will impact on many of the other development goals. And whereas if we can get this one going, it will have a big impact on people's health, livelihoods, empowering women, you know, tackling issues of poverty. So it just feels there needs to be this concerted effort and focus to get it back on track. The technology is there. The sort of infrastructure is there. There are thousands of solar enterprises out across sub-Saharan Africa. We know that. It's taking, yeah, it's developing these ideas that can, you know, and as we know, you know, if you can, once an idea is out there, it can spread rapidly. And then, yeah, we could turn this dream of 100% energy access into reality. Now, that would be a great thing to be talking about in
maybe,
yeah, I was going to say, who knows, 10 years time, but may you know, you never know. You set yourself a goal and just see what you can do to keep pushing it, to make it achievable.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for sharing it with us today. Best of luck with that. I'm sure one day it will happen for sure, hopefully sooner than later. But thanks very much, Richard.
You're very welcome. Yeah, it's been a pleasure as always to share stories and talk.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you're inspired. If you're working in a charity, to think about new ways to use storytelling to really listen to your donor base and unlock those, that golden thread, if you like, or the heart of a story, to really engage them long term, and also to think about how philanthropy and commercial or social enterprise hybrid type models could work potentially in the area that you're working on. Thank you so much for listening. Obviously, be in touch with us if you have any storytelling needs. We work across film, animation, podcasting, events, and more. And do give us a shout out. Let us be in touch if you know, whatever it is that you've heard from the podcast that you're enjoying. Leave us a review, subscribe, all those good things. I look forward to you tuning in, hopefully next month, and listening to our next episode. In the meantime, have a really, really great month, and we'll see you then.